it's Becca on the other side.
Okay, so I would say, I was just saying it was an exciting period. So the most exciting aspect of the result, even in this blurry image, to me, was that part of the enzyme that was very floppy in the absence of a substrate became rigid when the substrate bound. Mm. And we saw that as essentially new electron density in the map. Okay. So where there had previously only been islands of disconnected density, which represented a floppy loop, now in a new position, sort of leading like a bridge to the banks of this sort of dispersed region or unclear region, now was clear density for a loop of 10 residues. And so this was a case where the enzyme wasn't this rigid template like a lock and key situation that you often hear. It wasn't that the lock was all sitting there waiting for the key. It's that the lock formed when you put the key in. And that's a very special sort of thing. And another way to say it that is more technical but leads to my postdoc is that the enzyme folded, finished folding, only when the substrate bound. Mm-hmm. And so,
which means that the structure's function issues, I mean, are obviously very, very important or basic to the, you know, the protein transport, protein code, I mean, just the whole function of a cell. I mean, I guess I'm talking...
You're asking why is that important? General about that?
Or what's great about, well, so, you know, people talk about there's, you know, this molecule and this one and this binder and this receptor and this ligand, you know, and you're kind of like, okay, but really what's, it's just a bunch of goop and here you're talking about a bridge kind of going through this muck, you know, and here's this connection, as you say, like just the key and boom, it goes, right? And so, yeah, I guess I'm trying to... Okay, why is it important?
Why is it important?
To get a nice bridge in the middle of all this chaos or murk or something like that. Not muck.
Well, so this was a case where we basically looked at the result and noticed, the protein folds.
But all this talk about protein folding and so
it's not finished until it... Okay, and so then we thought, well, are there any other examples of this? And it turns out there are lots of examples of this. And things that we knew about at the time are, for example, the coats of viruses don't finish folding until the nucleic acid is assembled inside. So the nucleic acid binding parts are not these rigid things like coat hangers just that the nucleic acid
hangs on.
They become intertwined with nucleic acid as the whole thing assembled.
Yeah. Okay.
Some other examples are that were known then include repressors, genetic repressors, which seem to have disordered bits or arms that in general wrap around the DNA. So we looked and said, the first question was, okay, part of trisphosphate isomerase folds, is this an isolated thing, or is it something general? And it turns out it's general. And so then we thought about why could this be designed this way? What are the advantages to the molecule, or what are the properties of the molecule that arise from the idea, or from the fact, really, that part of it's unfolded in the absence of substrate. And I think this was something actually that I thought about more than anybody in the lab. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those situations, I mean, it happens to all graduate students that you end up thinking about one thing so much that you end up getting to, you know, a different level.
That's the point of the whole, of the whole business, right?
Exactly.
That you finally have enough.
And so, I don't know, I really felt like this was something
this was your,
I keyed on, and it turns out that there are advantages in terms of thermodynamics or consequences in terms of thermodynamics. And that the connection was simply that to get the protein chain to sit still, in other words, to fold, the interactions had to contribute energy.
To the process of the folding, or?
Right, that is, just to pick one possible conformation out of the many, it takes energy that favors that one over all the others. Okay, and that energy of interactions comes from all the types of molecular interactions you can think of. Hydrogen bonds and charges and getting rid of water and all the things that people think give rise to interactions. Mm-hmm. But the point is that this type of coupling of binding and folding meant that the binding energy had to be weakened compared to a situation where the protein was already folded before the substrate got on. Okay? And so that makes things more reversible. In other words, it's something that keeps binding from being too tight. That is, let's take trisphosphate isomerase. If the protein was completely folded to start with, then the substrate might get on, but not get off as easily. And it turns out that the slowest step in that catalytic reaction is the release of the product. That the enzyme itself has evolved to be so fast that all the chemical transformations are rapid. And what slows the reaction down is just letting go.
Okay. And now it goes back to, I mean, it really is a reversible process in vivo.
Absolutely.
And then it kind of just gets done again. And
right.
I mean, it's just kind of sitting there to be used as the...
Right, as the catalyst. So the thing that was sort of shocking was that here was a mechanism that people hadn't really appreciated that had evolved to allow things to be released. Now, in the case of viruses, for example, there's an obvious application or ramification there, which is that if when the virus gets into its host cell, the thing has to fall apart. So if it binds the nucleic acid too tightly inside the head, it'll never uncoat and allow infection. So anyway, this was an idea that, I don't know, I guess occurred to me, and I talked to Greg about, and he said, oh, it's a great idea, write a paper. And it's one of these sort of twists in science. So this was, to me, one of the most important parts of my research. I wrote a paper and submitted it, and it was rejected from the proceedings of the National Academy by someone who worked in this area before and said, "Oh, this is completely obvious." Although he couldn't point to a place where it was in the literature before this. You know?
In other words, he just didn't bother to point to a place, or you resubmitted? I mean, was there an actual exchange, or you just couldn't see anything?
Yeah, so when you submit to the proceedings, you pick someone who's in the National Academy, and you send it to them.
Oh, I see. Okay, it's not a review process that's anonymous, right?
Right, exactly.
Or they send it off then, finally,
right.
to
so
be
I
reviewed
So I felt it wouldn't be right to send it to someone else to get around that judgment.
Oh, no, of course not.
First person.
would it? I mean,
right.
Or they'd be highly, you know...
So
who was it, just since it obviously was...
Oh, it's all right.
Oh, God.
No, really.
You're just making some poor historian do some extra legwork here, but okay.
No, it was someone, you know, who I think is a great scientist anyway.
Oh, and I'm not saying you're right and he's wrong either.
Yeah, right,
I'd be curious actually to whether you did discuss it with him. Name or no name.
I didn't know him at the time.
Okay.
I just knew his work. I sent him the paper. He said he had worked on this idea with respect to the question that when substrates bind to enzymes, they have to adopt one shape as opposed to many possible conformations. And so part of what weakens the binding of substrates to enzymes mm-hmm. is the fact that the substrate has to adopt a unique shape. And I just sort of turned the coin over and said, ah, well, right. the enzyme also has to do that, and that weakens binding.
Mm-kay.
And he said, oh.
Well, he saw it as tautological or something?
Well, it was something I think that was obvious from his work, and it just that he never emphasized it.
Or bothered to demonstrate.
Yeah, I mean...
Or suggest that he could even lead anywhere, I mean, or was worth, you know...
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was disappointed because I thought, look, here's this small turning over of the coin, mm-hmm. but we... Or in the paper that I wrote, which is in my thesis... But it's never
which I've got.
It's never been published. I demonstrated a concrete case with transphosphate isomerase and then generalized it to other biological mm-hmm. molecules and sort of discussed the general implications of this. And so the paper was rejected. Greg, on the other hand, thought it was a great idea, so he would go talk, when he would give lectures, he would, mention this.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he said that probably we should submit it to the Proceedings of the Royal Society, and David Phillips would be a great person to receive the paper. You know, he'd be really excited
right.
because it was about transphosphate isomerase. Yeah. So yeah. I rewrote, you know, did some rewriting and sent it to Phillips. And Phillips sent it out for review. And the reviewers came back saying that, one of the reviewers said that it was all fine, but this was Petzko's idea. And Greg wasn't an author on the paper.
It was just you, right. And so, as you said, this was you. I mean, we've already established the fact that, Petzko wouldn't have... You didn't ask him to put his name on the paper, and he did not...
No,
I
asked him to put his name on the paper, and he said no.
No, it's your idea.
Yeah,
right.
No, I said, I thought, you know, he should definitely be on the paper, and he kept saying no, no, no. So it was...
There comes that time.
Yeah,
right?
And the irony is that if he had put his name on the paper, it would have been published, but...
Because he had probably heard one of the lectures, you think. The reviewer perhaps had heard it.
Absolutely, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that is
irony.
So it
was this funny catch-22, you know. And I became so discouraged that I gave it up, exactly. But, on the other hand, it led to some sort of lasting friendships because I did circulate the paper, essentially privately.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, got to know some people. Peter Kim read it, liked it.
Which is, I hope, some collaboration we can talk about because we'll get the other side of it, I hope.
Oh, yeah, so he was a
you make sure he is, right?
at the time, and, yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Is it something, I mean, just we'll cover it, I think, in more detail later if it is, but is it something that is manifested in later work, or is it maybe manifested only in the sense that it's a way you think, or a kind of a coin turning as an idea about something you constantly do with other, you know, with the work you look at. In other words, you kind of do a reverse take on what people are saying is, you know, I mean, this man told you this is obvious, but indeed the opposite was obvious or demonstrable, or had some, you know, some had been demonstrated in his work, but indeed, you know, what you were saying was almost, you know, the other side of the coin indicates, you know, not the same, right? Related, but maybe even opposite, right? So I'm kind of curious about the results of this work beyond the fact that it's led you to collaborate and do, I mean, does it, you know, focus?
Well, it's certainly something that is part of how I view proteins and motions and dynamics mm-hmm. and just the question that Greg addressed in his work is really what are the functions of protein motions? And he was working on that when I was a student mm-hmm. and that's why I thought this was important
sure.
and he's still working on that question.
And this is one aspect of it,
yeah,
or one
exactly.
chapter.
And the fact that that's a problem I take away from having been a student in that lab.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
is it,
sure.
Is it one of those problems, in other words, that I'm not saying it wouldn't, I can't imagine, you know, what the results of it would be in an applied sense of knowing these things or in a sense conceiving of or having a much better picture of protein-protein interaction or protein, you know, mm-hmm. substrate interaction or all of that. But is it one of those issues that it is about a why, it's a why question, and how question that perhaps a lot of labs and a lot of scientists and a lot of people funding science aren't necessarily, you know, we really don't care why and how. We just want to know if we can, you know, redo it or we can insert something in to alter it. It's, you know, alter the process to, oh, you know, deliver a drug or,
yeah.
You know, that sort of...
I think you could be a little more generous to say that it's...
It's
a question that is hard to address experimentally.
Okay.
And that's been the hang-up. It's not that it's not important. It's that it's what to do.
I guess what I was wanting to oppose there are scientists who, and I'm not saying one's better than the other or, you know, is got the wrong idea about science or is doing it for the wrong reasons, but that people who just want to know some answers to questions because the questions are there without getting into the Mount Everest routine of why did you climb it because it's their sort of thing, but who are doing science regardless of its potential outcomes you know, this question, you learned about it in Petsko's lab and you've been thinking about it since then, okay? Again, without regard for its marketability or its tractability or its...
No, I mean, on the contrary, I could list a set of practical applications to knowing the answers to these sorts of questions, but...
But that's not what's driving you to ask the questions. Or maybe...
Well...
I'm not being still generous enough for you, or it's... Not so
yeah, I mean, if you're asking me personally
about motives,
what motivates me, I would say it's curiosity. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, as I get on in my career, I'm starting also to see that there are more and more practical applications of the work in the lab, and part of that is that the technology for making the applications has mm-hmm. exploded since I was a student.
You know, so there's just more interest of all sorts in it because, again, accessible, perhaps.
It was hard to do everything compared to now. You know, it was hard to sequence a gene. You know, people
and you wrote a whole 20-page paper about it, right?
Okay, so we sequenced transphosphate isomerase, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll come to that.
Yeah.
That was the next thing. But that was a time when labs couldn't sequence. And it was because you just couldn't get commercial reagents that worked. And you had to be careful. And you
postdoc and it power, might, right? Like 50
work.
To...
No, that wasn't it. It was... And now you don't even think of sequencing as you buy a kit, you know, and you, mm-hmm. you do it, or you send it to the sequencing facility. You send your plasmid, you know. Then it was a major technical thing, and I'll come back to that. But you know, making a peptide, forget it. Who could do that? And you know, making a gene. Oh my God.
And now,
that
of course,
was unreal.
You go down to the you can do it from a keyboard, really.
You send the graduate student downstairs and they plug in the sequence.
And
it'll
even probably get delivered.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So it's it's a different world. And so mm-hmm. I think that's in part why I tend to think a little more about practical applications just because they're so much easier to to accomplish.
And I guess I want to make one thing kind of really explicit, though, just for anybody listening to that. And it's an issue about I'm not looking for you to justify
on practical level what you're doing. I'm actually rather interested in the okay, because that would be like getting Galileo, you know. So why did you, you know, why did you really push this heliocentric universe? What good, you know?
Well,
it probably did help us get to the moon, now, didn't it? But you know, the practicality of I'm trying to think of good examples anyway. Just to make that that I'm not kind of really challenging you on that issue. I rather actually, if there be, you know, my bias is, you know, and I kind of admire the person who's willing to answer that they do their science because it is there. And that's something that they, like you said, a graduate student, the success of a graduate, of your graduate education is getting good enough at things and asking questions and looking at particular things well enough and long enough and with the collaboration of others to finally get your own. You know, to see something that nobody else has seen.
No, I don't know. I think it's not that simple.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be that simple when you're a graduate student, right? Because you have very little responsibility except
that one
one thing, right?
That's your opportunity to maybe be that kind of selfish and focused or whatever.
And it may be that you have to have this curiosity to be dogged, as you say, you know. But if I had to tell you, you know, what motivates me to do each task each day,
right?
It's not, because the first thing that comes up would not be curiosity.
No.
It would be, well, to practically keep my lab running, I have to do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, I have responsibilities to people in the lab. I'm trying to teach them things. I want them to learn how to do science, so that's why I'm doing this. It's not because I'm curious about something.
You're going to doggedly pursue these questions,
Well, there are other motivations.
Right.
Right? There are other outcomes or goals or products. People are part of the products.
Sure.
In an academic situation, it's not the same as just turning out the answer.
Or asking the hard question, you know, maybe, or something like that. Although, they can be done together, right? I mean, certainly Perutz had the same kind of products as people and whatnot by asking the same questions or going after the same answer for a very long period of time. If we can use him as a
Right, but this is a good example of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't do science the way Perutz did science. Because
God knows he's not even doing science, but he used to do science.
Right. I mean, one sort of simple way to say it, in addition to the fact that he's that much smarter than I am.
I was not inviting.
What I meant by that, what I meant is that I can't get funded to do something for 30 years and tell you that in the year 2020 I'm going to give you the answer.
That's right.
Or maybe not. I can't do that.
You
know, there isn't
money.
A person in this country who can do that.
Not even the pew's going to do. They'll do 4 years, right? But not 30. Which is, I mean, I guess in this world, in this current day and age, very generous of them on that level, right? I suppose.
Oh, that's great. But you know, I mean, there are examples from that time. Barbara McClintock is maybe another example.
Who, at the same time, you turn around, you know, was poorly remunerated for. I mean, she was not supporting a whole lot of people, and she wasn't necessarily paid even well. But she certainly was. Yes, she certainly was given the opportunity for years and years and years to pursue the same. You know, and she had the space and the time. You're right to do it. And other people, her colleagues, recognized her abilities as that kind of never stray from the path, and they gave her the opportunity to do it. Really, you see, there's not a place, that you just said, not a place in this country where you could do that anymore. You couldn't find anybody, and maybe you couldn't do it at the level you're doing without all these people as well. In other words, you couldn't really go off like Barbara McClintock and kind of just be on your own and maybe get, you know, some summertime.
Well, maybe I said it right the first time, and I'm just not that smart. You know?
No.
So I'm not. I don't have that much insight to be able to say, okay, here's a problem that is very hard, and mm-hmm. I'm sure I can solve it if I just work hard enough.
Well, I won't do the ask you to prognosticate the next 10 years of protein crystallography then either. If it comes up and you bring it up, that's fine, but okay. I won't ask you to do that.
Anyway, so to get back to the chronology, the meeting in London was at the Royal Society, which is in a beautiful part of town. Mm. And in that building, there is a drawing of Dorothy Hodgkin's hands.
I've never heard this.
And she's got crippling arthritis, so they're very, you know, distorted. But just the whole idea that this is something that is done by people, that is connected to culture. That has meaning in that sense, aesthetic meaning. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's something I assume now. Mm-hmm. It's just I find it a distracting thing, actually. It's not very useful in terms of, as I just said, turning out the product. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some people would be shocked. I mean, I hope my study section doesn't listen to the tape or read the transcript where I'm saying, well, the whole point is not to turn out the product. You know, I mean, that's heresy, I think, among some people. And I'm sure you've come across different attitudes in your
as there are people, right? There are entrepreneurs in the real, I mean, and they call them, they do on tape, this is a business, and they are, you know, they'd be really good, I suppose, marketers of, you know, cameras if that's what they had got into. And then there are others who are like, you know, no, this is a religious, you know, experience akin to joining a monastery, you know, taking vows in an order and that sort of thing. So, there's, and of course all those, if you want to call them stereotypes or myths or types and paradigms of the scientist exist as well. I mean, and I'm not saying everybody's a mere stereotype and stick figure of this type, but and that's what we, I mean, those are the, I think, the parameters within which everybody who has a job that they think of as more than a paycheck.
Yeah.
And even, I think, some people who do their job as a paycheck, right? There's a whole issues about what's that in your life and how you...
Well, yeah. And people go through different times in their lives.
Sure, it all is a paycheck, right?
Uh-huh. Okay, so...
I
got back from London, and the major thing that had dawned on us was that the sequence of these trisphosphate isomerase wasn't close enough to anything else for us to interpret the details of our electron density matter. And at that time... this is a story about luck in science. It turns out one of the features of MIT is that there are few or no intercollegiate sports teams. And as a result, the intramural program is very strong and very serious.
Kind of takes place in maybe that. Is there a fraternity, sorority system on campus?
Is. Yeah.
Oh, okay, so then it won't take the place of it.
No. It fits right into it. And the biology department had a volleyball team. The championships were coming up. And I had played in college at Santa Cruz.
You even said, you
NCAA.
You guys had done really well when you were right. That was at SC, right, where you were? UCC. Second or?
Oh, no, that was in high school. But
high school. Yeah, I thought it was NCAA.
Santa Cruz, we were the pretty bad.
Oh, okay. The sea slugs? Oh, they weren't the sea slugs then, were they?
Banana slugs, yeah. You know, we'd get in games against Santa Barbara, which was the national champion at the time because we were in the same league, but they put in their third team and we'd score 2 points and such, and that would be the game. The levels were quite different. But nonetheless, I had played, and I was recruited into the championship game for the team. And one of the other people that was recruited had played for Berkeley. He was a postdoc in Dan Frankel's lab at the Harvard Med School. And so we played the game and won. And we're in the locker room afterwards, and we were introducing ourselves, and what do you do? And it turned out he had just cloned the genes for most of the glycolytic enzymes from yeast.
From what?
From yeast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Just so happened. Just so happened. Met him on the volleyball court.
Right, when we're, you know, sitting there taking a shower, and that's very funny. My God, you've got this gene, you know. Well, by the way, I just saw the structure of that enzyme, and we really need the sequence. And it turned out he was enough of a biologist that he wasn't adept or very good at sequencing. His name was Glenn Kawasaki. And I was more of a chemist. And back then, we were using Maxim and Gilbert's method of sequencing. It was all chemical sequencing. Right. So we immediately started a collaboration. Right? He would teach me how to make the plasmids and use restriction enzymes and things like that.
True collaboration, then, right?
And then we would sequence this thing together. And so to do that, I went back to Alex Rich's lab because he had a little group of people led by Hank Cronenberg who was working on parathyroid hormone. And they had been sequencing. But it turns out that parathyroid hormone, the whole gene is only a few hundred bases. And so they were using methods where maybe they could read on their gels maybe 80 bases at a shot, you know. And trisphosphate isomerase was like 1,500 bases, and we were going to get killed. But nonetheless, you know.
80 at a time, and how long does it take to get the gel to read 80, right?
Well, okay, so you start into this, and Hank was really wonderful to work with. And, of course, Alex was very generous to let me in the lab. And, you know, I did things, broke equipment and things like that, and did some crazy things.
But not on purpose.
And anyway, Hank Cronenberg had been sequencing the way that he had always done it or had first done it.
Mm-hmm.
But he had kept up a knowledge of what other methods out there were being used. And he didn't really want to try them because he thought if they didn't work, he wouldn't have gotten those 80 bases. But he was perfectly happy to tell me, oh, well, maybe you should try this.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Okay, it's back on.
So Hank made suggestions, and then I sort of walked around MIT to the different labs that were sequencing at the time and said, oh, how do you do it? And how do you do it? And how do you do it? You know?
Get out of here, get out.
And eventually, you know, I'd get ideas on how to change the standard procedure. And so we slowly made improvements to the point where, you know, we started to read 200 or 300 bases at a shot. And the sequencing went pretty well. We got most of it done really quickly and then got stuck in a region where there were no restriction sites, no places to cut the DNA. And
like a huge...
Yeah, and we really got stuck, and it was really frustrating because getting the last little bit was quite hard. You know, just to give you the setting, this was a time when Bob Weinberg's lab was discovering restriction oncogenes, but they couldn't sequence them. They collaborated with people at Cold Spring Harbor to sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another lab at the Institute.
Right.
There was a very highly recruited graduate student at MIT who ended up in David Botstein's lab, and basically her project failed because she couldn't sequence the gene.
And that's what she was kind of like being brought in to do, was to sequence the gene.
That was a key part, yeah. So it was something that people had trouble with. It was considered hard. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was really wonderful working with Hank because he would just say, oh, just try this, you know, just try this. And all these things would work. And then, of course, Hank would do it and it would apply those improvements to his projects. It was very good. It was a fun time.
Yeah.
And we got the sequence in. It was pretty funny because we used the fit of the sequence to the electron density map to add a little bit of support to the idea that we'd gotten the sequence right. And that was, of course, very unusual. The sequencing labs weren't doing it for, mm-hmm. for crystallography. But nonetheless, the sequencing taught me, or to do the sequencing, I learned some of the basic rudiments of cloning and handling plasmids and sequencing.
Which obviously would do you in good stead when you got to Oregon, right?
Exactly.
And well, any biologist can.
It's interesting you mentioned the difficulties of sequencing. One of your colleagues talks about, you know, doing a grad student project, basically in a protein, you know, purification lab where they wanted to learn to, you know, purify proteins, and they were set the task of she was set the task of sequencing a gene and doing some cloning work, and without anybody to be found anywhere, and this is in St. Louis, anywhere, until somebody, what was her name? Sarah Tillman showed up to give a talk and actually, like, overnight saved this person a lot of time and trouble mm-hmm. and showed her a few tricks on how to use mm-hmm. you know, some of the splicing part. She was basically on her. So it was an interesting time to just hear about these kind, you know.
Well, yes, it's something we got to take for granted, but it was hard. And there was an article that Maxim and Gilbert wrote for Methods in Enzymology that, you know, had very detailed protocols, and most of what we did was straight out of that.
Yeah. And it still gets. I mean, I know that it's the Moniatis and Sandbrook that really get cited, but you know, you still see the. You go back far enough in the literature, you still see that was the
paper.
Cited paper right before it was taken over by the other one.
Yeah.
So it's on.
So anyway, I think because of this work unfolding, or the recognition that trisphosphate isomerase had to fold, that got me interested in the problem of folding. It was a problem that Greg wasn't interested in, and also that maybe that was another reason that I was attracted to it.
Well, uncharted or not uncharted territory, but
it was more individual or something.
And
more.
I mean, it kind of obviously grew out of your background, but it was, as you said, you know, it had a lot to do with your own thoughts on the subject, and
yeah,
to the point that he wouldn't even put his name on a paper. So.
Yeah. So when I was finishing, I applied to three labs for postdocs. Richard Henderson to work on bacteriorhodopsin, Lyle Jensen in Seattle, and Brian Matthews in Oregon.
Where's the first guy? I'm sorry.
Cambridge.
His name is, so Harvard, though not.
No.
Or one of the hospitals.
MRC.
Oh, Cambridge.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And for it's kind of weird. Why do people make decisions to go to places? I mean, I talk to my own graduate students about this now. How do they decide where to go? So I had some strange criteria. One of the things I wanted to do was to be closer to my family. So that led to a bias against Cambridge, and then right around that time, three-dimensional crystals of the reaction center were published. And in the event, had I gone to Cambridge, I would have gotten killed on the problem of membrane protein structure.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the issue, you know, could you determine the structure of membrane protein?
And so that's what you were...
Well, that was to me one of the most exciting things in structure, or the other one being, you know, folding and stability mm-hmm. issues. So that Brian Matthews had published a small number of papers at the time where they had used mutants and compared the properties of mutants screened for, viral mutants that have been screened for by sort of traditional genetic methods to try to understand where the properties of proteins come from in the system T4 lysozyme. And I think, you know, I went and visited Seattle and Oregon, and I felt like the work that in Oregon was the most exciting.
So your dad was in the, your dad and your stepmom, they were in the Bay Area, right, already?
No, they had moved to Seattle area. Right. So that was one of the attractions of going to Seattle, is I'd be in the same place. But I, in the event, I felt like Oregon, the work was more interesting, and I could always jump in my car and
I can't be up in Seattle
in 6 hours. So
yeah, I was going to say, I'm from New England, so everything's really close. I mean, originally, but yeah, it's still, it's close. It's pretty, it's not even a day's drive, right?
Yeah. So anyway, went ended up going to Oregon in
So you visited it? I mean, you visited all three?
Yeah.
Okay. And they said, sure, come if you want.
Yeah.
No, there wasn't any, was there any kind of heavy, you know, breathing down your neck by any of them? And aren't you coming and lots of phone calls? Or I'm not, again, trying to just, you know.
I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
If there was, it didn't make a difference. You made up your own, you know. You had found three places that, and you checked them out and you picked the one you wanted.
I'm
sorry.
Anyway, so out in Oregon, I think the thing that happened when I got out there is serious decompression, and really realized how intense maybe it was MIT and finishing had become, and so.
If the postscript of your dissertation is any example, I mean, I can see that there it must have been very. You know, it just seems like a large, like I almost thought, I think when I read it, I was like, I wonder if he had like sort of like the PhD's equivalent of postpartum depression after, you know, getting all this work done. It's just an acknowledgement of all the help, and it just seems like a very intense sort of experience being expressed in your postscript, and so you kind of maybe
go back and read.
Yeah, you're kind of recapitulating that, if you will.
Well, the effect was I didn't work that hard. Basically, I went through a period of sort of hanging back, built some furniture.
This was something that worried you, or something that made you feel really different. Great?
Well, it's it didn't really worry me, but knowing what I know now, it should have worried me.
Knowing what you know now, meaning that you see how that hurts other people, or?
Well, no, I mean, you have to be dogged to get anything done at some level. And
you think it slowed you down then?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How many years were you in the lab there?
Ooh. Seven?
Mm-hmm.
Long time.
That is a long time.
Six? Two?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's more six. I mean,
yeah. But that's a long time.
That is.
I didn't really realize it at the time, but it's a long time. Part of it is I couldn't find a job when I was looking.
I was
going to
say,
the
7 years today is, you might as well shoot yourself in the foot, right? I mean, isn't that almost like you're going to automatically be questioned on your job interviews? Why are you there 7 years? I mean...
Sure, yeah.
Is this supposed to be 2 to 4?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Maybe it wasn't so true then either?
Well, it was only 6 anyway.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think the other thing is...
Maybe Matthews wasn't... I mean, he's a laid-back kind of guy too, or...
He's laid-back. He's very competitive scientifically.
Yeah.
He's personally, he's very...
And he didn't push you out,
easy to
though.
Get on. No.
He wanted you to hang around forever then, maybe, huh? Very competitive when you think about it, though.
No, I mean...
We say that
No, it wasn't like that. I did have problems getting a faculty position, and then when I took a faculty position, it takes quite a while to renovate a lab and So between, it took over a year to move after I had decided to move.
To Utah, you mean?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean.
Because I know when I first met you here at Berkeley, you were also, I mean, setting up here then, yeah. And you were kind of, this is taking too long, and there's no, you know, there was some, I mean, I don't think you had electricity or something at one point.
No,
so
equipment,
it was
yeah.
very frustrating for you, and perhaps this is the reason why it had already happened like a couple of years before, and it was frustrating.
Right, so anyway, I ended up doing a long postdoc, but I got to the lab. By the time I got to Eugene, the easy things that I had proposed to do were already being done by other people in the lab. And, you know, I was not very well, highly motivated.
At first.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd go
was
to
this a personal, I mean, sort of thing? Or just, you know, you were burned out a little, maybe?
I was burned out, yeah, definitely.
So it was a matter of kind of, you know, R&R to
yeah.
get going again.
Yeah.
Because you certainly did a lot. You know, you say it was a long, we say here it was a long postdoc. There's an immense, I mean, I've got it on my lap, you know, there's a lot of work that came out of it. It seems that was collaborative in many ways outside of, you know, direct, you know, the direct kind of work you were doing, as well as full, you know, with that
yeah.
breadth and depth.
It took a long time to gel. That was one of the, mm-hmm. the things. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. No, we've got like a good minute and a half or two, so one. No, you want to just cut it short for today?
Oh, no, just change the tape.
Oh, you want to keep going?
Yeah.
What time is it?